I promised that I would provide something by way of a review of the material that we covered in class on November 11th, and I have not yet done so, and so I rush in the course of these closing hours before the end of classes for the first semester to try to fill a little bit of this gap, and it is an important one. In the class on November 11th, our principal topic for discussion was the notion of liquidated damages. Now, by liquidated damages, we mean that the parties have, when the contract was made, included a provision for remedy in the event that there is a breach by one or the other of the parties. Theoretically, the liquidated damage clause could be written to cover the liabilities of each of the parties, although it's more common to find liquidated damage clauses which only cover the behavior or the breach of one of the parties, that being the party who did not draft the agreement. And the common law courts had a good deal of trouble deciding what to do with these liquidated damage clauses. And in the end, they came up with a formula which I think ends up being more deceptive than helpful. The formula went something like this. We'll enforce a liquidated damage clause provided that the liquidated damage clause is not a penalty. That is, that the courts recognized that the one serious problem with clauses that prescribe remedies is that they could be used by the more powerful party, the party with the greater leverage during the negotiation. They could be used by that party to inflict a punishment on the other side should they breach. Now, we've been through the development of remedy law and contracts, and so we're familiar with the proposition that the contract remedies are not designed in the first instance to penalize. They are designed to compensate. And so one way of looking at this core formula is to say that the courts were simply announcing to parties to contracts that they intend to critically review liquidated damage clauses to make certain that they are designed to achieve the objective that is supposed to be achieved by contract remedies. That is, one which is designed to compensate the aggrieved party, the non-breaching party, for losses that they have sustained by reason of the breach. Way in which the courts chose to implement that suggests, however, that that was not the only reason underlying the court's desire to scrutinize liquidated damage clauses. The test that the courts came up with, and you can still see this test in the restatement formulation of liquidated damage law, is that in order for the court to be persuaded that the court should, in fact, impose the remedy called for by the liquidated damages clause, the court would have to be persuaded that at the time the parties made the contract, they could reasonably have believed that in the event of breach, it would be difficult to determine the loss and measure the loss for the application of normal compensatory damage relief as would be prescribed by a court of law in the general run of contract breach cases. Second, the parties must at that point, at the time the contract was made, they must have come up with a reasonable remedy. Now, the oddity, of course, is that we've just said that these would be cases in which the remedy would be thought to be difficult to determine, and yet the parties are being given the freedom in exactly that case to describe what the remedy would be. Now, you can come up with various justifications for that particular set of criteria, and to some extent, they may not be entirely an articulation of the concern of the courts. Nevertheless, those are the two tests, and those are the tests you will be expected to apply as a lawyer. We'll see in a couple of minutes that there have been some changes made in the Uniform Commercial Code if the contract is one which involves a sale of goods, but even there, the changes are minimal. So again, the two tests. Number one, the question is whether or not the parties could reasonably have believed at the time the contract was being made that should there be a breach, it would be difficult to determine damages. And number two, that the parties have made a good faith effort to determine what those damages would possibly be. Assuming that the particular liquidated damage clause meets both of those criteria, the court will enforce it. Now, the cases, as you read them, also suggest a kind of level of skepticism by the courts about liquidated damage clauses. And I think that that skepticism, which has been somewhat moderated now in the last several decades, but the reason I think was that the parties are, after all, walking into an area which has historically always been the province of the courts. That is, the parties, through the theories of freedom of contract or contract autonomy, the parties can make up whatever deal they want to make up. But it has always been the courts that say whether there's been a breach, and if so, what is necessary by way of a remedy to achieve the compensatory goals of contract remedies law. And so there is a little bit of protection of turf involved in this particularly close scrutiny that courts have historically given to testing the validity of liquidated damage clauses. It's also the case that, at least looked through the lens of the modern contract transaction, that more often than not, liquidated damage clauses are among those clauses which are rarely negotiated. They are just there, and they are put there by the more powerful of the two parties. Certainly, for example, in consumer transactions, the contractual language is written by the manufacturer or the retailer, most likely the manufacturer, certainly never by the consumer. And so these cases, so-called contracts of adhesion, some people call them, that is where one party writes the contract and is in complete control of the formation of the contract, that in such contracts, perhaps the courts ought to look with very close scrutiny at the question of whether or not the remedies clause written by this more powerful party is in fact a reasonable remedies clause. When I say reasonable in this context, I really mean the kind of remedy that a court would come up with, would have come up with in the absence of any writing. The Uniform Commercial Code has moved a little bit, but not very far, from the traditional common law. All that it adds is that the court should enforce the liquidated damage clause not only if the court believes that it was reasonable at the time the contract was made, but also, parenthetically, even if it was not reasonable at the time the contract was made, that viewed at the moment of the breach and looking at the circumstances of the parties before the court, the liquidated damage clause seems to be a reasonable approximation of the damages actually suffered. And so we have two different ways of validating the liquidated damage clause. One being that it's reasonable, looked at from the vantage point of the parties at the time they made the contract, or even if that is not reasonable at that time, the clause will still be valid and enforceable if the remedy it calls for, looked at as of the moment of the breach, is a reasonable one. The tensions here, of course, are, as I alluded to a moment ago, between the theories of autonomy of contracts, a freedom to make contracts, here coming into collision with the court's desire to scrutinize the clauses the parties include. You remember, of course, when we talked about consideration, the courts make it clear over and over again that they will not inquire into the equality of the bargain or the fairness of the bargain beyond avoiding the enforceability of contracts which result from duress or fraud. But that aside, the parties make the deal, and it's not up to the court to review the deal to say, oh yeah, this is a good deal or a bad deal. It's the deal the parties wanted. Now you see a distinctly different attitude historically when it comes to the parties prescribing a remedy in the event of breach. And I think it's fair to say that as time has gone on and bringing us through to the last 40 or 50 years, the courts have decided, have been more persuaded by the theories of autonomy and freedom of contract than they have been persuaded by those who would argue that, well, after all, the remedy is really up to the court, and no privately constructed remedy should be enforced unless it seems to approximate what the court might otherwise in its absence have done. If I'm right about that, and I think certainly if you do a head count of cases, it certainly appears that I am, the question then becomes, well, what are the circumstances under which the court will decide that that is not true? That is, that this liquidated damage clause is not enforceable. And there are some, I think, some hallmarks of when the court may so find. If the remedy calls is in an amount which is vastly larger than the value of the contract, the court is more likely to conclude that it really is a penalty and not an enforceable liquidated damage clause. Or in cases in which we have a long-term contract and a contract, therefore, in which a breach early in the contract would have dramatically different consequences for the non-breaching party than if the breach occurs very late in the contract, and yet the liquidated damage clause shows no responsiveness to the passage of time, you may find the court saying, no, 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 this is not a valid liquidated damages clause. Interestingly enough, the code has actually added to the real law of liquidated damage clauses by including a provision which talks about those clauses which it is permissible to include. So, for example, it talks about including provisions which may limit the ability to recover consequential damages. And that is, after all, a kind of a negative liquidated damage clause. That is, it describes what damages may not be recovered. On the other hand, it does it in the form of validating something that the parties do. And so I come back to my earlier comment that the direction of the law seems to be that unless the clause is obviously outrageous, that is, obviously a penalty, it is likely now, or more likely now than in past years, for the court to say, okay, well, we will, in fact, enforce it. The further it seems from the kind of remedy the court would have conceived of as appropriate for the breach, the more likely, of course, the court is to say, no, we don't think this is a valid liquidated damage clause. And the typical language is it's a penalty. One of the jokes in this area is that the party's always right, as liquidated damages and not as a penalty, blah, blah, blah. But of course, the party's declaration in the contract that it's not a penalty and that it is a valid stipulated damage clause is of no weight, carries no weight at all with the court in its critique of the liquidated damage clause and its evaluation of whether or not that is or is not an enforceable clause. I think if you look carefully at the language both of the restatement and of the Uniform Commercial Code on liquidated damage clauses, you will see the similarity between them, and you will see the thrust of how the courts have reviewed the doctrine that the courts have used to review the enforceability or the non-enforceability of liquidated damage clauses. I hope this review of this body of law has been helpful to you. And again, my apologies for the failure of my recording equipment, or rather my failure to get the recording equipment to work properly during the class in which we discussed this material.